Hello and good afternoon. Welcome to Star-K's monthly teleconference, web conference, brought to you by KosherClasses.com. I'm Rabbi Tzvi Goldberg, and I'm joined today by Rabbi Mordechai Frankel, who is director of our Halacha Institute at the Star-K. Today, we're going to be discussing, I guess, what you could consider to be a hot topic, which is the issue of bugs in the fish, worms in the fish, specifically the Anisakis worm. Helping us today with the technical issues is Reb Zev Steen, as usual, and getting everything in order and make sure it functions properly. We have two ways of joining us. One is through the internet at dimdim.com, D-I-M-D-I-M. The keyword there is kosher. That's our class name. And you can also join us through the telephone if you're driving or wherever you are. You can join us wherever you are in the world through the telephone. There is no particular charge unless other than your own telephone company charges. 218-895-1203, 218-895-1203, and the passcode is 2020 pound. And this class is given at the last Wednesday of every month at noon, and it's archived, it's videoed and archived at kosherclasses.com under podcasts. So we have put up here, for those of us joining us by the web, we put up a diagram from CDC, that's the Centers for Disease, that's part of the U.S. government, of the life cycle of this particular worm, which has taken the kosher world by storm in the past couple of months. And really, this little worm, which maybe measures an inch or two, is giving us a run for our money. So let's just go through briefly the life cycle. If you can see the diagram, let's see if I make it a little bit bigger. Basically, and I want to just also preface that we're not experts in fish physiology or parasites. We're not scientists, and halachic issues we're also delving into, but we don't consider ourselves to be the experts on it. We're just trying to provide for you, our audience, an overview of what is happening, and try to give you an idea of where we are today and how we got there. But by no means is this the final word, and it's not even the final word for the Star-K, which is right now reviewing its policy on this particular issue. So, how does the worm life cycle look like? So basically, the mammals excrete eggs. They hatch, basically, and I'm sure I'm simplifying this. They hatch in the water, then they're eaten by other sea creatures like krill, and in the cycle of the marine life, those krill and crustaceans are eaten by other fish, bigger fish, maybe like a salmon, and then those fish are eaten by even bigger creatures like mammals, and then again the eggs are laid and then excreted and so on, and it's following like that for a long time. That's the way that God created the life cycle. So in between there, though, the human beings get involved when they catch the fish like salmon and other types of fish and they eat them. So that is where the question arises of whether or not those worms that you may find in the fish are permitted or are forbidden. I want to mention that you can join us and ask a question. If you have, you can chat with us on the Dimdim. Just there's a chat box there on the right side of the screen. So Rabbi Frankel, give us a little bit of a background. I mean, if I'm eating my fish and I see a worm in there, or there's a worm, I mean, why should that be permitted? We know that Jews are not permitted to eat worms. They're insects, toloim, they're shrutzen, whatever you want to call them. So let's start with that side of why possibly would it be permitted to eat those?
Well, the surprising fact is that not all worms are actually forbidden to be eaten. Even though it is true that the Torah does tell us not to eat worms, there are certain parameters which the Gemara delineates. The Gemara tells us that although most worms cannot be eaten, there are certain worms which the Gemara considers as having been grown from their beginning, from their birth, from growing inside the animal, inside a fish or inside a mammal, or potentially inside a plant as well. And the Gemara says that those worms which their whole life cycle, they grow inside the fish and they have never seen the light of day, they are part of the fish. They are just grown in the fish, they start in the fish, they grow in the fish, they stay in the fish, and they're part of the fish. And just as much as a person can eat a fish, so a person can eat the whole fish, including everything that grows inside it. Now, if a person is eating a fish and a person sees one of these worms, even accepting what the Gemara says, that it might be permissible to eat the worm, perhaps nowadays it could be that since people look at worms as unappetizing things, there is another side issue, which is that a person is not meant to do things a person is not meant to eat things which they think are disgusting. So it could be that for those reasons, of course, you should not eat the worm. But if a person is not aware of the worm, doesn't see the worm, if it really is true that that worm has always from its inception been inside the fish, it would be permissible to eat that worm, and certainly it would be permissible to eat the rest of the fish. And that statement of the Gemara is brought in the halacha in the Shulchan Aruch. It's brought without anyone disagreeing with that. That seems to have been a universally agreed upon concept, which is relied on for ever since the time of the Gemara till nowadays.
Okay, so there's a clear law mentioned in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law, that if there is a worm in the flesh of the fish, it is permitted. And however, if it's in the stomach of the fish, then it is forbidden.
Right, that's right? Correct. If it's in the stomach of the fish, that means that it is not a worm which grew inside the fish. The reason it's in the stomach is because the fish swallowed it, which means that it was outside the fish. It was living outside the fish. It grew outside the fish, and the fish swallowed it. So since it was not inside the fish from its conception, it would be treated as a regular worm which cannot be eaten.
Right. Even if you would hold that it would be forbidden, then yes, you could remove the worms and eat the fish, and that's actually what those that forbid this. This worm, what they suggest, what they require, not suggest, what they require is that you remove the worm. It's much like checking a vegetable. If you have romaine lettuce that has worms, not worms, they don't have worms, they have thrips and aphids on them, then you remove those thrips and aphids, you check it for the bugs, you remove them, and then you eat the rest of the vegetable. So it would be no different than that.
So again, as you mentioned, checking these fish would necessitate taking a flashlight, shining it through the fish, just as checking vegetables, the person has to have a certain expertise that they know what they're looking for in order to check. Well, the same thing would be true over here. A person would have to familiarize themselves with the checking process and know what to look for.
Right. Especially if the fish is a dark color, like it's pink or red, there is a special way that you have to check that with the ultraviolet light, because you won't be able to just see it plainly. So it is sort of a new process. Even people have been checking vegetables, housewives, or caterers, mashkichim have been checking vegetables for many years, but this would be a new process. Okay, so Moshe is asking here, does your fish store need now to have a mashkiach to make sure it does not have these fish? Okay, so that's the question. That is the $64,000 question of whether or not we're going to require stores to have a special supervisor to make sure that these fish are not being served, or if they're being served, that they're being checked. And much like the vegetables have to be checked. That is the question. So let's get back to the halachic, some of the halachic issues. Let's take those opinions, which is a strong opinion of those that that forbid this worm, and they say that even though the Talmud and the Shulchan Aruch, even though they state that worms in the flesh are permitted. But that is only if you you don't know where it comes from, and we sort of assume that it comes from the flesh itself. It spontaneously generates somehow, or we don't see it coming in, even though we may know it comes in from the outside. We haven't seen that. But if we have proof that the worm comes in from the outside, it has a life cycle, it's found in the stomach, and it goes from the stomach into the flesh, so then while it was in the stomach, it was forbidden, so then it moves into the flesh, and we have they have seen apparently that they have a fish, and they open it up and they see the worm wiggling from the stomach into the flesh, so that seems to indicate that this type of worm would be then forbidden.
My understanding is that the fish swallows the krill, which contains the worm. The worm then resides in the fish's stomach, and it'll stay there as long as the fish is, generally it'll stay there as long as the fish is alive. When the fish dies, so then the fish is taken out of the water and it dies, so its temperature starts rising. When the temperature starts rising, so then the fish's stomach is no longer a good place for that worm to live, so it'll start to migrate out from the stomach and pour its way into the flesh to find a better place to live. So that is why, even though the worm was eaten and was in the fish's stomach, that's why it'll be found in the skin. If the fish is chilled and kept cold after it's caught, then these worms will tend not to be found in the fish. It's the fact that after the fish is caught and it dies, the fish starts heating up. That causes the worm to migrate into the skin.
Right. So we saw that there are studies that show that even though there may be a high percentage of worms in a particular species in the stomach, but if they gut it right away, then the worms are not so common. So I've seen some studies that show very high percentage, let's say in wild salmon, of the Anisakis worm. But that doesn't prove necessarily that it's going to be found in your canned salmon. That's just saying, those studies are just showing that they opened up the salmon and they saw in the stomach perhaps that there is a high percentage. That doesn't prove that in the canned salmon there's going to be a high percentage. That there are studies, some of the kosher organizations have been doing studies on the percentages in actually the canned salmon.
When they can the salmon, they don't can the stomach contents.
They don't can the stomach, but the question is whether or not, like you say, was it gutted right away? Was it did it die first? And so, as you pointed out, that all affects the percentage of how it's going to how many worms are going to be in the flesh, because that is also another halachic issue we should mention about the miyat ha-motzui. How prevalent is it, right? If there are the fact that there may be a worm in the fish does not necessarily, and even if that worm is forbidden, doesn't preclude us from necessarily eating the fish. It depends How prevalent is it? I mean, I could find a worm in an apple, but does that mean I'm obligated to check every apple? No, because the preponderance don't have.
Yeah, that's two separate issues. One issue is if you see a worm in an apple, certainly has to be removed. That's clear. The question is, are you obligated to check an apple? Do you have to suspect that there might be a worm there, which would necessitate checking? So generally, since worms are generally not found in apples that we have, there's no necessity to check it. If you do see one, one would have to remove it, but one doesn't have to check. The same question could be posed by this fish. Certainly, if you see the worm, then according to those who are stringent about this, they feel that this worm is a problem. Does that necessitate that you have to check every fish? That would depend on the prevalence, the likelihood of this worm actually being in the flesh.
Okay, so that is another question of how common it is. We have a comment here saying that it is very common in the canned salmon. Okay, I mean that's his experience.
I think the question we still have to address, which we still is, assuming that you do find a worm, assuming it is very common, ultimately is this worm going to be one of the worms which is considered as having generated in the fish and is permissible to eat, or is it a worm which we would look at as coming from the outside and being forbidden to eat? And that again, as you mentioned, that is the big question. What are the criteria by which we would consider a worm as being from the inside and being from the outside? That is the debate among the contemporary rabbis over the contemporary poskim.
Right.
That's how we look
so
at this worm.
Another point is that those who permit this worm, some argue that the rabbis do not expect us to become fish pathologists and experts to know exactly the life cycle. The Gemara, the Talmud, in learning and deriving this permissibility of worms in the flesh of fish, is sort of giving a blanket statement, and does not depend on us really following the science. The Torah doesn't require us to become scientists. That's their argument. Again, we're trying as much as possible not to take a position, because the Star K is still reviewing its own position, which it's trying to discuss what the different opinions are. So they argue, those that permit, that the Torah doesn't require us to become experts. And even if the scientists claim or can show us that they come from the outside, that's irrelevant. It's sort of a blanket permissibility given by the Shulchan Aruch and the Talmud.
At the simple reading of the Talmud, it almost sounds like the Talmud is telling us that these worms, which are found in fish, are like spontaneously generated within the fish. They don't come from the outside. Scientists tell us that all worms, whether worms in fish, worms in animals, worms in fruits, there's no such thing as spontaneous generation. They all come from the outside. Many those who want to reconcile science with the Talmud will tell you that even though that might be true, that scientifically they come from the outside, but that's not the way it's perceived. That's not the way it's looked at. When they come into the plant or the fruits or the fish, they're of such minimal size that's not significant, and therefore for halachic purposes, it's enough that we would consider it as having been generated within the fish. Again, the question would be, what is the cutoff point in terms of size? How small does something have to be when it's ingested by the fish? How small does it have to be that we would say that insect, that bug, is so small that even though it was ingested by the fish, we would look at it as having just grown from the fish? And when is the worm considered big enough at the time of ingestion that we would say, no, this came from the outside? Until recently, even though the Sanisacus worm was something which was known about for at least 100 years, the understanding, at least among Rabbonim, was that this fish was microscopic at the time that it was swallowed by the krill, and therefore could certainly be viewed as not coming from the outside, as having been generated within the krill or within the fish. A lot of this, the reason this issue has come back on the table and been revisited, is that it seems to be
it's actually bigger.
It's actually bigger than
right.
that.
It's bigger. It's visible. Now, there is a question here. If the Talmud and the Shulchan Aruch permit this, why does Starkei even need to weigh in? Because it's so clear that it is permissible. Well, it's really not so clear. As a matter of fact, our understanding is that the Gedolim, the great sages in Israel, who live in the land of Israel, have come out with a statement that these are actually forbidden. I mean, so that's the latest news.
I mean, again, it's clear that the Talmud says and the Shulchan Aruch says that there are certain worms which are permissible.
Right.
That's clear. The question is whether
these are those that are permissible. And I've seen some point out that there are perhaps that the Talmud was referring to other types of worms, which would be actually common in that part of the world.
I mean, one does have to say there is a certain. That argument is there is a somewhat compelling argument that the Talmud does not distinguish between different kinds of worms that would seem to indicate that all worms are permissible. Those that are lenient on this issue, that is the argument that they would present, that the fact that the Talmud does not distinguish between types of worms allows one to assume that all worms would fall under the blanket leniency of the Talmud.
Right. The reason I don't think we mentioned the reason that it would be permitted, after all, aren't worms worms? Is that it's not? They may not be called a sheretz hamayim. They're not called an insect, a creature of the sea, if it grows in the flesh of the fish. So it doesn't. We can derive from the Torah perhaps that it is permissible. Let me take a minute just to mention that we are here at the Starkei offices. I'm Rabbi Tzvi Goldberg. This is Rabbi Mordechai Frankel. And you're joining us either on dimdim.com, where I see actually that we have reached the maximum amount of allowed participants. So if anybody had trouble getting through, that is the reason why, because I guess this issue generates a lot of interest. It is opening up a can of worms, as they say, and that's really what the. But you can still come through on the telephone because we have unlimited ability on the phone. What is the final opinion of the Starkei? I'm just reading one of the shorter questions. I see there's some that are they're going to take me some time to work through, but there is no final opinion yet. And we're not here to give you what the final opinion is. Originally. Rabbi Heinemann felt that these worms were included in the Talmudic leniency. However, he's considering the issue again, and right now we're on hold. If you would want to see which fish are included and which are not included, so Rabbi Bess from California, on his website, let me see if I can bring that up. It's kolyaakov.org. So it's kolyaakov.org, and that site on that's the shul site. That's Rabbi Bess's site. He has some reason the computer is not allowing me to look that up, and I'm not sure why. But on that site, he lists his latest research of which would be problematic. So let's just go through some of that, Rabbi Frankel. Of course, we have the canned salmon, which is the wild salmon, as we mentioned before. Canned salmon is always wild, and in the wild, the salmon swallow these worms. We have some flounder, some particular types of flounder, yellowtail, wild dabs, etc.
Another flounder, the fluke flounder, is fine.
Where is that? Oh, fluke, Georgia Banks, and channel flounder.
Definitely.
Are okay. We have sardines are problematic if they're from Norway or Scotland. And, the following fish do not require checking. We have carp, farm-raised salmon, which we mentioned before. Gefilte fish, herring fillet, we have sardines from Morocco, Philippines, and Portugal, tilapia, tuna, these are all fine, and whiting fish, and white fish from Michigan. So I think this list is changing. So it's not, even that is not the final word on it, because as they go through the research, so they're coming up with different different conclusions. Can you please send the list in the email so we can print it? We could try to do that. Again, the website is kolyakov.org. Okay, let's see what else we can deal with. Here's someone claiming, I was in Alaska in a salmon cannery. Where did that go? Got lost. Where did our Alaska visitor go? Below it?
Yeah.
Okay, and from each salmon fish, they can 5-6 cans. And they can the entire fish, including the stomach area. Well, not the stomach itself. As a matter of fact, about 4 cans will have a part of the stomach area. Okay, I assume that doesn't mean the stomach itself, meaning the flesh around the stomach. Okay, well then it could have worms, and it very well probably does have some worms. The question is, again, how many, and the research is coming in on that as well.
I think this is an important question. Is there pressure to offer this? Is that why Rabbeinu is revisiting this psak? Again, the whole issue is being revisited because of the continuing research. There's a lot of facts which, the scientific facts, which at least the rabbinic community was not aware of till it was brought to their attention recently. You know, I think that Rabbi Heinemann will tell us what he feels is the true halachic opinion, and how he feels the sparky should conduct itself.
Now, this question that I think is on a lot of people's minds: what happened in previous generations? I mean, this is not a new invention, this Anisakis worm. It wasn't created yesterday. So, and all of a sudden, in the year 2010, people are now raising the issue: what happened 50 years ago, 100 years ago, 1,000 years ago, and we haven't really heard about this, and how can it be that all of a sudden this is an issue? That's the question I think that's on a lot of people's minds. What would you say to that, Rabbi Frankel?
Well, again, the Talmud tells us that, and the Shulchan Aruch tells us that a person is allowed to eat fish with worms in it. Again, without any knowledge, one would assume that that the general worms which are found in fish would be included within this leniency that the fish are considered as having grown within the worms are considered as having grown within the fish. That might be true, but when a person can actually show you the video of this fish swallowing it and of it coming from the stomach and worming its way out, so then it becomes somewhat clearer that this whatever worm it is that the farmer is talking about possibly was not the one that we have nowadays. You know, we have certain rules of in the Torah, like following the majority and following the status quo, which a person is allowed to rely on. Even a person is allowed to rely on those kind of rules, and so one knows the status quo has changed. One's allowed to rely on the status quo, and even if one eventually discovers that the status quo changed in the past, that doesn't mean that one was doing something wrong at the time that one was relying on the status quo.
He had a right to rely on it at that point.
Yes, I think so.
Right. Also, there is some discussion of whether there is a greater incidence of this worm nowadays. There are studies. I have a lot of paperwork here, but I can't find it right off the top of the stack. There are studies that show that the incidence is much greater, and the amount of worms that you find now is much greater than it used to be for whatever reason. I don't know exactly what the reason is, but there are studies that do show that.
Again, as you mentioned, the obligation to check would only exist if there's a certain likelihood of finding it. It could be that in previous times it was less likely to find these worms and there was no necessity to check. Possibly nowadays it's more likely.
Right.
Also possibly nowadays perhaps these worms are not microscopic. Perhaps in previous times they were smaller. Again, depending on things do seem to change in terms of the
could be that it changed over time. Someone is asking, what are the names of the Gedolim, the rabbis in Israel in Eretz Yisrael, that came out with a statement to forbid it? We don't have that. We don't yet have a copy of that, so I could not provide you with that list. But I have it I understand that it is going to be made public shortly. So, the
I think you mentioned the kind of the most. I think the compelling, those who are lenient, the compelling reason to be lenient is because you know, we're having this whole discussion over here based on all this research done by various scientists. Again, is the layman expected to know all this? Does the Torah obligate the person to be an expert in fish science? That would certainly be a reason to say that a person is allowed to rely on the simple reading of the Shulchan Aruch. Again, the alternative approach would be that now that we seem to know definitively that these worms are not the way they're described in the Shulchan Aruch, so then perhaps the leniency does not apply to them. That's the crux of the debate to my understanding.
Right. Now, I realize why the computer was not allowing me before to bring up this webpage, Rabbi Frankel, because I put in the wrong address. Computers don't make mistakes, people do. So it's not Kol Yaakov, it's actually kehilasyaakov.org. And that is K-E-H-I-L-A-S, Yaakov is Y-A-A-K-O-V, one word, .org. And here it is, I was able to bring it up now. And this has the list from Rabbi Bess of the current fish which are on the permitted list and those that are problem. It seems fairly likely that what's going to happen is that there are going to be, as the questioner asked before, there are going to be mashkichim supervisors at the facilities to check the fish. That's the way it looks like we're going to require that, and so it really should not make that much of a difference to the consumer. He'll still be able to eat all the fish that he would like. And I suppose in terms of salmon, what they can do is either they can have a supervisor there full time, which actually the Star K requires anyway for any fish production, in order to see the scales and ascertain, forgetting about the worms, just to make sure that it's a kosher fish. We do require that anyway. So at any Star K production, there has to be a supervisor there anyway. Now, those that don't require a full-time supervisor, either they would require it, or they perhaps can arrange the process of that cannery so that it doesn't cause any problems, so that they gut it at the right place, at the right time, they freeze them at the right, you know, at the right temperature, and so on. You know, I just want to mention that the reason that the government is interested in this also is that this parasite, when a human ingests it, is actually dangerous for them. It could cause some disease. So if a person is eating raw fish that's not properly cooked, it could and has this worm in it. It could be very problematic for the dangerous, unhealthy for the human. So they want to make sure that the fish is either properly cooked or frozen, because after it's frozen at a certain temperature for a certain amount of time, I don't remember the exact details, it dies. Now, and it doesn't cause any problem for the consumer in terms of health, but it's still a dead insect or worm is still forbidden. The fact that it's dead doesn't play a role in the kosher world. So even though something may have approval of the government health authorities, that doesn't mean that it's going to be okay for us. Okay, somebody here is trying to put out the letter that has been signed by the rabbis in Eretz Yisrael, in Israel, and it's here on the chat. I guess you can read through it. Okay, I think we will. It's been an interesting discussion, Rabbi Frankel. It's a discussion without yet a conclusion for us at the Star K. We do not yet have an official policy about it. We're reviewing it as all halachic issues are subject to review, and the rabbis in Israel also have reviewed the issue and come out with their psak. And we have to see now what Rabbi Heinemann will say now that we have this this letter from those great rabbis. I want to thank everybody for joining us. This discussion is archived at kosherclasses.org. I want to thank Reb Zev Steen for all his technical help. Actually, we also have the ability to put the video up on that site, right? So that's another ability that we recently were able to put together. This class is held at the end of every month on the last Wednesday at noon at dimdim.com and by phone. Where's the phone number? 218-895-1203. Pest code is 2020 pound. And someone is asking, what is the current recommendation? Well, if we're not giving a clear leniency, so then I guess it would be prudent to be careful about it. What would you say to that question, Rabbi Frankel?
I'll have chicken for supper.
You'll have chicken for supper. Okay. I mean, yes. I would say that every person should ask their own particular rabbi. Go to his aseilach harav. It says every person has to have his own particular rabbi who he follows, and you should ask him.
This is a legitimate debate, and there are different rabbis with different opinions. Persons have the right to rely on whatever opinion his rabbi decides.
Should rely on his rub. Again, I think so. Hopefully, that we provided some information that will help you in this navigate these waters. Excuse the pun. And as usual, you're all welcome to be in touch with us either by email at star-k@star-k.org or by phone 410-484-4110. 410-484-4110. Thank you very much for joining us, and have a very good day.